DC sports fans start their day with 106.7 The Fan's Sports Junkies.
Let Jaden cook.
With Commanders talk.
They were 60 minutes away from the Super Bowl last year, and they're better this year.
And a lot of fun.
You're acting like I haven't been embarrassed in my life before. Right.
Every morning from 6 to 10.
I thought I handled myself with incredible maturity.
If you missed it live, listen to 106.7 The Fan's Sports Junkies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
They're listening to everything you do.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Early September.
This is not good.
Oh, no.
Here comes the training staff, Joe Espada and Josh Miller, after Luis Garcia just delivered that last pitch to Clement.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Well, that's it for Luis. And that's so frustrating. He's had so many setbacks over the last 2 years. And his second start back, he is going to leave the mound here in the second inning. Unfortunate.
Oh, man.
It has been a tough road back.
Seriously. And as good as he looks to start this game, too.
This would be the part that I would have the hardest time living with if I were an athlete, Seth. And for those who didn't watch the game last night, what you were listening to, right, excuse me, right there, what you were listening to was Todd Callis and Jeff Blum reacting to Luis Garcia leaving the mound five outs into his second start back in the major leagues. We should point out, his first start back in the major leagues, 8 days ago or whatever it was really good. Pitched six innings, gave up three runs. It was one bad inning where he gave up a couple home runs. But by and large, over that outing, he looked good. He looked good in his rehab outings while he was experimenting with a new arm slot. He looked good last night. He hadn't given up any, he hadn't given up a hit when he got taken out of the game last night. The hardest thing for me looking at this, because look, if this is another elbow, like anything happening with an elbow in Luis Garcia, it's got to be a question as to whether or not he's going to be able to ever pitch again, right? I mean, it took him two. It took him 2 years to get back, or at least pitch at a high level again. The thing I would have the hardest time with is the fact that, I mean, Luis Garcia is going to wind up having made a few million bucks, you know, having pitched in the major leagues. But you can be a mediocre pitcher these days and get completely generational, life changing money.
Yeah,
you can get 4 years, $40 million, and be a guy with an ERA in the high fours these days. You know?
I think that given the length of his rehab, I hate to jump to conclusions because hey, sometimes guys re-injure the same UCL and they come back from it. It's not unheard of, but it seems like the cards are stacked against him in a lot of ways. And we don't know that maybe this is just genuinely inflammation, another setback. He had a lot of, I mean, his rehab took a long time, but then the very end of it, it was kind of the smoothest, even though he had so many setbacks early on. This now puts us, like, I don't want to think about what it means for his long-term future, but if I had to bet right now whether or not he plays the rest of the season, I think there's a really good chance that he doesn't play the rest of the season or the postseason this late in the year. We talked about those three pitchers returning from the IL, Javier Arrigetti and Luis Garcia. And I think we used to throw McCullers in there for a while. So let's put those in there. Because I used to say with those four guys, if two of those guys come back to some semblance of the best version of themselves or close to the best version of themselves, all right, I'm cool with that. Well, three of four of them are currently either injured or pitching horribly.
Yeah.
And so Javier is the lone remaining hope in that quartet of people.
It's crazy. So those three, you had Caleb Ort and Bennett Souza in the last 2 weeks, go to the IL with injured elbows. Josh Hader is dealing with a shoulder. That's the only separation between Hader and these other guys is that it's just a different injury. And then add on top of it, Seth, if we just want to take the season in its totality, they went into the season thinking that their starting rotation was going to be Hunter Brown, still healthy, Framber Valdez, still healthy, Ronel Blanco, done for the year with an elbow. Hayden Wesneski, done for the year with an elbow. Spencer Arrigetti, he's got an elbow. Now, he's probably done for the regular season. It doesn't sound like the long-term severity with Arrigetti is what it was for these other guys. We haven't heard anything about Tommy John for him or anything like that. But there's 18 games left in the season. Anybody who gets hit with this elbow thing going around the clubhouse right now is probably useless to you for the rest of the regular season.
What percentage of the total elbows that are on the pitching staff for the Astros this season or have been on the pitching staff for the Astros are actually healthy at this point? Like out of
barely half of the guys that started the season, you know?
Yeah. Like you got like 6 healthy elbows out of 12
right.
at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So I mean, you kind of posed this question earlier. Like is this an Astro issue or is this just bad luck? I mean, we have no way
of
knowing.
As of August of last year, there were at least 4 teams that had more Tommy John surgeries in Major League Baseball over the previous 4 seasons.
Yeah.
It feels like if you sliced it back to these past 3 years, including 2025,
it can't be
I'm
close.
Guessing the Astros have got to be up there at the top.
It can't be close to the last 3 years. I mean, and these are prominent guys they're losing.
And to be clear to anybody tuning in, we don't know what exactly Luis Garcia's elbow injury is, but it's elbow inflammation, which more times than not ends up being something not so hot.
ESPN did a ranking. They do this every year about this time where they rank the core talent on the 30 Major League Baseball teams, who's got the most core talent. And I thought what was interesting about this, a couple of things. The Astros are ranked 8th, so okay, they're in the upper third. And that, you know, look, as tough as this season has been on Astro fans, this is still a team that's leading the AL West by a game. I mean, they're still leading their division. They are in the playoff hunt. I'm looking at Fangraphs, Seth. 79% chance to make the postseason. So there's plenty of teams that would trade spots with the Astros right now. I thought it was interesting in this exercise ESPN did. They take the talent, and these are the core are guys that are going to be with the team for at least a couple of years.
Yeah.
So Fromber is not part of this exercise here. You know, you got to be somebody who's under contract or under team control for at least 2 more seasons to be considered part of the core. You know, this is a forward-looking type of thing. Jeremy Peña and Hunter Brown are considered the 2 elite Astros. Yordan Alvarez is considered in the category of plus. The 3 categories are elite, which is the best, plus, and then solid. And
Do they explain why Yordan is in that?
They don't.
They must be looking at just either production this year or what the hell?
Or health, or just health. Like he misses time every year.
I mean, since he came off the IL, he's 19 for 43 with 10 walks in his first 53 plate appearances. I think that was before his final plate appearance. That wasn't before the end of last night. But, he's been pretty damn good.
He's been good. It's got to be. I mean, he misses 20 games a year at least with injury. That's got to be
the reason. But still, I don't know.
I'm with you. I think you and I are both surprised he's not considered part of the elite of this core.
If we're using several years or if you're factoring injuries into it or what have you, like, okay, Peña has been, you're going to put Peña above Alvarez for what they've done over the last few years?
Yeah. So Peña and Hunter Brown. Plus players, Yordan, Carlos Correa, Paredes, and Josh Hader. And then they've got a slew of guys that are considered solid. I think it's interesting. You get a feel for where Jose Altuve is kind of settling in here in these latter years. He's considered a solid guy of this core. And that is kind of where he settled in. He's not a useful defensive player anymore. He's a disaster on the base paths. But he can still go get you 25, 30 bombs a year and hit about 270. So.
Yeah, the ones that, okay, Bryce Matthews and Jacob Melton they have is solid.
Yeah.
So they're the youth part of it there. And then Ronel Blanco is on there too, which doesn't make me feel good at all about just, please remind me more of the various guys that aren't available to the Astros right now.
I think what's interesting about this whole thing, this exercise, is that in 2022, they had the 3rd best core in baseball, the year that they went on to win the World Series. In 2023, they had the 5th best core in baseball, the year that they would go on to lose in the ALCS to the Rangers. In 2024, they had the 7th. So they're kind of gradually descending this sort of list.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, they got swept in the wild card round. Now they're 8th. You know, the next step is to not make the playoffs in this whole thing. You know what I mean? It is interesting how the rankings, because they do these rankings before the season is over. So it is interesting that, you know, that 3 years ago, the year they won the World Series, they're 3rd. The year they lose in 7 in the ALCS, they're 5th. Last year they get swept in the wild card round, they're 7th. How do we feel about Jeremy Peña and Hunter Brown being Astros long term? You know, Peña is now an all-star and he hired Scott Boras. Hunter Brown, I think, has Scott Boras as an agent.
So we get to have that fun. It's just become such a great annual exercise in which guy do you keep and what do you who's worth potentially stretching a little bit on your salary parameters.
Yeah.
Between Hunter Brown and Jeremy Peña, have to choose. Knife to your throat. Which one you taking?
I'll take Peña just because of all the, and this isn't this isn't because I feel like Hunter Brown's the next elbow guy. The pitching is just, first of all, this organization has been decent at grooming pitchers.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I think it's the same reason why people, if you had to pick Framber or Tucker, most people would have picked Kyle Tucker. It's harder, you know, it's the Astros have been able to find pitching. I just, all these elbow injuries have spooked me into giving any pitcher, you know, 5 years, $150 million, you know, that kind of thing. And that's, you know, that's the neighborhood Hunter Brown's going to be living in.
Now I'm depressed just even thinking, it's hard. It's one thing when you have to say goodbye to Correa and all of that, and people are upset about that at the time. But you're still in a relative, at that point, you're still riding high.
Hell yeah.
You know, you still feel really awesome about everything that the Astros have accomplished as of late, et cetera, et cetera. But then with each successive year, it's, now we're letting go of really good baseball players and the pipeline is not proffering up Jeremy Pena's and whatnot. It doesn't feel nearly as good. And you've seen what mortality looks like getting eliminated early in the playoffs, letting go of guys, whether it's Kyle Tucker or anybody else or Jeremy Pena or Hunter Brown. It feels more painful now.
Yeah, it does.
Than it was before.
It does. And I'm in favor of the way that Jim Crane runs the baseball team in terms of how he handles free agency. I don't want to give anybody a 10-year contract. I'm completely in favor of that. The issue is that you had this period of time, part of it because of the sign-stealing punishments where you had no first and no second-round picks for 2 years, and part of it because you traded away a bunch of guys because you were in a World Series window, so you traded away prospects. You've been in a period here where your minor league system has been widely viewed as bottom five. Now, for a bottom five minor league system, they've cranked out a lot of guys that have helped at the big league level. I will credit them with that. But eventually, you got to pay the pipe. Like, eventually, this catches up to you. You know, you don't have enough good players in the minor league system, and this is what happens. Your core goes from third to fifth to seventh to eighth. Next year, it'll be 10th or whatever, you know. So, I thought that was an interesting exercise. Did you see where the Philly Karen, the woman that demanded a baseball back, a home run ball that was hit in her vicinity?
Yeah.
It was very, very legally scooped up by a father by the name of Drew Feltwell. He was there with his 10-year-old son for his son's birthday. This is at the Marlins. To reset for people who didn't see it, the Marlins and the Phillies in Miami were playing. Ton of Philly fans there, a lot of them in the upper deck. Harrison Bader hits a home run in this game, and it lands on the ground in a row where there's some Philly fans, and this Drew Feltwell runs down the row, didn't run in front of anybody, the seats were empty, picks up the ball as others were reaching for it, holds it up, got the ball, walked over, put it in his son's glove. Happy birthday, son.
Yeah. Didn't jostle anybody.
Nope.
Didn't elbow anybody out of the way. Certainly didn't elbow a kid out of the way.
Yeah.
But the woman that was standing in the row above that was not making any kind of real aggressive attempts to get the ball. Angrily dashed over and demanded that he give the ball to her because that's her baseball.
That's her baseball. This is,
and when you say that he did it legally, I would say by the large majority of people who say the unwritten rules of scavenging a baseball are, look, it's first, whoever gets to it first, that's their baseball.
Yep.
And as long as you're not wrestling it away from a kid or even like overly physically competing with a kid, that's your baseball.
That's exactly,
doesn't matter
right.
How far you traveled, you got there. It was a clear path.
Here's what it sounded like. This is the Marlins broadcast watching this whole scene go on with Philly's Karen going over and trying to get the home run ball.
That ball hit the fan. Oh, the Phillies fan came in and he stole it from another Phillies fan. Oh, she can't believe it. Whoa.
Uh-oh.
Oh,
easy.
Oh, yeah. Yep. We have a little infighting here.
You know, he did give it to what I would assume is his son, maybe.
Okay.
Did give it to the youngster.
This lady's got to get it under control. Look at the girl in the background in the left-hand side of the screen. She's laughing.
All right.
Ugh. What is going on? That is weird behavior.
And let's get somebody from the Marlins to go out there with another ball.
And they did. The Marlins, to credit the Marlins organization, they went up there. They had a bag of merch for the kid. They gave it to him. It was his birthday. The kid got to go down in the outside the clubhouse after the stadium and meet Harrison Bader, who signed a bat for him, signed a ball for him. Apparently, there's this trading card retailer, Seth, named Blowout Cards, a big trading card company, who's offering Philly Karen. We don't know her real identity. It's probably a good thing.
People are calling her Karen Skunk Hair.
Yeah, Karen Skunk Hair.
She had like a black and gray thing going.
Yeah, she had like a complete mop of gray hair on top of what was clearly dark hair, like underneath it.
Yeah.
They're offering her $5,000 for the ball if she will inscribe on it, "I'm sorry." And they're going to give it to the kid.
So have we heard no word from her?
No.
About this at
they
all?
They actually misidentified her.
I know. I saw that. Yeah. Somebody doxed the wrong person.
Yes.
And so that poor person is getting all kinds of online venom, I'm guessing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that sucks. You know what the problem is? The problem with that is that it's once you get misidentified, it keeps going on and on.
Oh,
long after it's corrected, people stumble across a tweet here or something there, and it just keeps going.
That person went from being somebody just sitting at home enjoying themselves to A, their phone blowing up, to B, now anytime their name gets Googled for any purpose, that is the thing they're most notorious for, being mistaken for Karen's skunk hair.
She gets, when she goes to do a job interview and they Google her, it's going to show up. Like she's going to have to explain herself. No, that's not me.
No.
That's not me. It's a lesser version of what Jerry Sandusky, the broadcaster, has to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's enough people that are dumb enough to think that Jerry Sandusky, the child molester, somehow has an active Twitter account. But Jerry Sandusky, who's a sports broadcaster, has to deal with people coming at him all the time, calling him all kinds of names and everything.
Like, they would have hired Sandusky to be the play-by-play guy for the Ravens.
I don't know why Jerry Sandusky, the non-molester, doesn't just change his name.
I thought the same thing forever. And the more the years go on, the more I admire the fact, like, he toughed it out, you know?
He toughed it out, but I think there comes a time where the people's there's a subconscious association that goes on there, you know, where you're about to meet Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah.
Like your first initial impression before you actually even get a first impression is like,
we're going to jail.
And then Jerry Sandusky, the non-molester, has an uphill battle to climb, uphill hill to climb right from the onset in all these interactions.
Yeah, that's
I'll change it to Gerald so quick. Man.
Gerald or initials like JC. JC
Sandusky.
It's
like your name's like, okay, if you're... You've got a successful career in the year 1944, but your name is Adolf. You're changing that, right? I don't need to be any association with it.
You become AJ or whatever.
Right.
You're absolutely right. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. All right, does CBS have a person who is a treasure here in Houston warming up in the bullpen to replace Tony Romo? We will discuss that coming up next.
DC sports fans start their day with 106.7 The Fan's Sports Junkies.
Let Jaden cook.
With Commanders Talk.
They were 60 minutes away from the Super Bowl last year, and they're better this year.
And a lot of fun.
You're acting like I haven't been embarrassed in my life before.
Right. Every morning from 6 to 10.
I thought I handled myself with incredible maturity.
If you missed it live, listen to 106.7 The Fan's Sports Junkies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
They're listening to everything you do.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Did not get a chance to watch the Lions and the Packers, and the reason I bring that up is because that was the game that Tony Romo and Jim Nantz were on this weekend. So I didn't get a chance to see if Tony Romo, who I think the general consensus on Romo, Seth, is that he kind of hit rock bottom a couple years ago in terms of the prep and the stepping on Jim. The Super Bowl in 2024 between the Chiefs and the Niners was kind of the nadir for the two of them. Like,
Romo was really just phoning it in at that point. You could tell he wasn't doing nearly the amount of prep that he should do. He just didn't sound like he knew what the hell he was talking about half the time.
They botched the final call of the Super Bowl. Like, that's the worst. That is rock bottom. And I thought last year in the games I watched Romo, I'm like, okay, someone got in his ear because I thought he was better last year.
Reports that they had an intervention that offseason.
That's right.
The CBS executives actually went to his house to meet with him.
That's right. Still not to the level he was when he was this sensation back in 2017. Remember in 2017, it looked like his two choices for employment were going to be either quarterback for the Houston Texans.
Yeah.
That was when the Cowboys were all in on Dak after Dak's rookie year, or broadcast. I think he chose the right venture. I mean, he's the highest paid guy in his vocation.
Yeah.
So,
but he also, I mean, when you watch like Greg Olsen call a game, Greg Olsen studies. He knows his stuff. Yes. You learn a lot from it. Where, and you know, that's always the benchmark for me, is I like guys who can come in, and when they do a Texans game, I'm learning things about the Texans that I don't know.
That's a great way to
put it. As opposed to saying things like, what are you talking about? They never line up in this formation. They lined up in it 7 times last week.
Yep.
Like they and that's where Romo had gotten to me. Like, I just feel like he's learning about the teams as he's watching them play. As opposed to like Greg Olsen, Tom Brady, you might not like him and he might still need polish or whatever, but he puts the work in. He knows the team that he's covering.
Did you get a chance to watch any of JJ's debut?
Only little snippets, but I remember watching him. I went back and watched the Christmas Day one last year, and I thought he did a really good job on one. And like JJ, kind of like Greg Olsen, I think is going to be a guy that there's no chance in hell JJ is not going to be prepared for the game that he's going
to. 1,000%. A thousand. JJ's not going to embarrass himself. There's no chance of that. Andrew Marchand of The Athletic has an interesting theory, I guess I'll call it, about JJ Watt and his immediate elevation to the number two team. We should keep that in mind. JJ was on part-time studio for CBS, did that Christmas Day game last year on Netflix. Widely acclaimed to have done a good job, especially his first game ever as a color analyst. So as we all know, CBS moved J.J. Watt into the booth and shot him past everybody in the pecking order other than Tony Romo. Marchand is the media critic or media writer for sports for The Athletic. And he points out that, man, when Romo got that big deal back in 2020, $18 million a year, completely reset the marketplace for high-level color analysts. CBS didn't have a plan B. Like, Romo had them over a barrel, and he got a big payday out of it. Their next guy down with Ian Eagle at the time was Dan Fouts, who was aging his way out of the business. Charles Davis was on their roster as well. Not a big enough name. JJ is a big name who works hard at this, who's a future Hall of Famer, and who I think, and on Sunday, I think Marchand says here, JJ Watt showed potential with a foundation to eventually be excellent. And Marchand's point is that, like, when Romo's contract is up this next time around, they're not going to get caught with their pants down. There will be a plan B to elevate to the first team if they need to.
Yeah, I think it's perfect for JJ because he doesn't have the as high a profile. And I think he's going to be better at it at the end of the season than he was in week one. All the reports I saw were that he was really good in week one. So I think this is I would, if I had to bet money on it, he'll be the lead guy by 2 years from now or 3 years. When's the contract up for
Tony Romo's got 5 years left.
Oh, 5 years.
Deal.
Okay. Yeah. I would say 3 years. I'm going to say 3 years.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And do you?
I think they demote Romo and give him the option of whether he wants to work or not.
Now, that would be circle of life, because you remember what happened when Tony Romo got that gig, is that Phil Simms got booted to the studio.
Yeah,
so that would be circle of life if JJ were to come in and boot Tony Romo to the studio.
I know there's a lot of people that like Romo just because it feels like it's more fun. It feels like you're drunk at a party. The problem is, for me, it feels like he's drunk too. I want to be the drunk one. I want to be the drunk one who's got a jovial, good-natured, but teetotaling friend who's explaining things to me, being sure I get home all right. You know, there's too many times during the game that Romo just doesn't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
God help me. The next time I have to sit through Romo receiving an explanation from the rules official and not understanding the explanation, but then all of a sudden turning and agreeing with the explanation as if he understands it. I can't take it, Sean.
No, I get it.
These old bones can't handle the stress.
I get it. Marchand points out some interesting things in this article. And by the way, I'm rooting for JJ. I hope JJ's excellent at this. I watched the first 20 minutes of the game on Sunday because you and I had to do pregame at 12:25. And then I went back and watched not the cut up version, but I kind of did the whole fast forwarding through certain parts and watched it. I thought he did for the second time doing it, first time being Christmas last year, I thought he was great. I thought he did a good job. The things, there were one thing he got big praise on, the second thing that he, and another thing he got criticized on by Marchand. Marchand loved his enthusiasm, like big enthusiasm, like JJ, and I think that's really key. And that's what you talked about with Romo. Romo's got that enthusiasm.
Right. Though. People love it. It feels like a good time. Honestly, that's why a lot of people like Ross Tucker. He sounds like he's so excited to be at a football game.
Yes.
It gives you the feeling of like, oh, I'm there live because this guy is
totally
showing me how excited he is to be there.
It's contagious. Now, the one criticism that Marchand had, which is very fixable, too much of the what and not enough of the why, especially on passing plays.
Now, that'll be the interesting thing where because a quarterback obviously is going to have more, you know, at least in the eyes of the fans, credibility when it comes to the passing game, and then more just natural knowledge of it. And I think some of that, because JJ has studied this, and I think like a lot of times, like I learned a lot more about the non-line play part of football after I was done playing football than I ever did while I was playing football.
Yeah.
So like there's probably a little bit of a confidence level there too, where, and the other part though too, and this is one of the hard things for quarterbacks to go through when they become color commentators. It's that it's impossible sometimes to know exactly what coverage a team was in, even if you watch it on film 20 times, because there's little tweaks. And it might look like cover two, but it's like, oh, that's textbook cover two. But no, there's differences there. So you got to kind of be confident enough to speak about what things, how it looks like it actually happened. But if you don't want to go all the way there and skewer a guy who wasn't actually in the wrong, there's a balance to that. And that's the kind of thing that I think over the course of 17 weeks, JJ will get better at. And I didn't listen, so I'm just taking Marshawn's word for it.
Yeah, well, I texted you early in the game, like 12:15, I texted you, and I'm like, man, like I know it's early, but I think JJ is going to be really good. And to that point that Marshawn makes about, you know, maybe JJ not being comfortable explaining the parts of the game that when he was a player, he wasn't directly involved in, the part of the game I was watching was heavy on D-line stuff going on in the game. And I'm like, wow. I'm really learning a lot from JJ about why this guy did this, why this guy did that. Marshawn points it out, Seth. He explained what the D-gap was, which, you know, a lot of commentators will say things like, they're in 12 personnel. Oh, he gets right in the D-gap. This three technique, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
90% of the people don't understand what that stuff means. JJ explained it. He got on a casual fan level to give – didn't consume a ton of time, but he was educating people.
And that's honestly, if you go, people point to John Madden, you know, as one of the all-time greats and beloved, et cetera, et cetera. People got frustrated with John Madden because John Madden spent a lot of time explaining the basics.
Yeah.
So a lot of hardcore football fans, they choose not to remember this or whatever, but I can remember this because I lived in a house watching it with my dad and his friends, you know? So, like, people get kind of frustrated that Madden was breaking things down on such a basic level sometimes. But that's what the networks want.
Yeah.
That's you're cultivating the future NFL fans.
Yes.
You know, and the people that are afraid to ask their brother or their spouse or don't want to look dumb, it's nice when somebody just explains it. So you like, cause you never know which question is a dumb question or not. Everybody goes through that.
Yeah.
So I think that, I think JJ will probably try to be able to find that good balance between the basics and some of the more nuanced stuff.
So 3 years, you think, huh? That's your prediction? 3 years?
I said that, but then I remembered that Dan Fouts was in that role for about 20 years longer than he should have been. So like, Fouts was rough, man. It was rough to no, you know what? Fouts wasn't as bad as Dierdorf. Dierdorf was there way, way too long.
Yeah.
Fouts, I would say, probably lost his fastball somewhere along the way. Dierdorf was there for decades too long. That was awful.
My favorite Dierdorf memory, if I can personalize it, Dierdorf, Al Michaels, and Frank Gifford did the 1992 Sugar Bowl, which was Notre Dame and Florida. And my brother was the kicker on Notre Dame that year. He actually had to come off the bench to kick because Craig Hendrick, the regular kicker, tore his knee in the game. So my brother comes in wearing a defensive lineman's jersey because they went with the green numbers in that game, and they only had one of every number. So out trots my brother with number 96 in this dress practically. And he kicked a few field goals, kicked a few extra points. They won. They beat Florida in that game 39-28. But my brother had a kickoff in that game that duck hooked like way out of bounds, like horribly out of bounds.
Yeah.
And Dierdorf goes, "Huh, that's how you get to be three off the tee." Like a golf analogy. I'm like, so anytime I think of Dierdorf, I'm like, yeah, he clowned my brother. So JJ Watt.
How bad was the kickoff?
It was bad. It landed like behind the people that were standing on the sidelines. Like he,
so they started off field position.
Started at the 35 or whatever it was. Yeah, it was late in the game, but it was, he's like, oh, so you get to be three off the tee. JJ and Kevin Harlan would be good. This is a text. Ian Eagle is damn good at his job. Yeah, Ian Eagle and Kevin Harlan are both excellent.
Harlan's the one that I know a lot of people say, like, well, what do the announcers really do for getting people to watch or not? I just enjoy watching Kevin Harlan or listening to Kevin Harlan.
Yes.
When I hear him on the radio, I've stayed listening to games that I'm not really paying attention to all that much, just because I like the sound of his voice. And I think he does such a good blend of kind of the old time classical sports announcer voice, but yet with a sense of humor,
yeah,
and almost like a little bit of an irreverence while still setting the scene really, really well.
Yeah.
There's nobody better than him in my mind. He's by far my favorite.
He does play-by-play when drunk people run on the field.
Right, yeah, right, yeah.
What did he say? Yeah, the guy is true.
You know what he is? He's like the guy that he's an electric guitar player, but then you find out he also plays the 12-string classical guitar or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like he can do it all. He can do it all in one concert.
Yep.
In one concert. You go, you're thinking you're going to go watch a banjo player, and all of a sudden he whips out a harpsichord and does a pleasant melody. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a slow day. We just got to play a bunch of Kevin Harlan stuff. He's you're right. He's excellent. No question. Hey, we are trying to get new books into the hands of kids in low-income homes in Houston. This is an effort we do every year. And if you're unfamiliar with the correlation between child literacy or literacy in general and the quality of society that we live in, you can look up some numbers. Just know that there is a serious correlation to crime and mental health when it comes to literacy. So the sooner we can get books in kids' hands, the better off we're going to be as a city. And 61% of kids in Houston don't have a single book in their home. Let's rectify that today. A $30 donation to the Barbara Bush Houston Literacy Foundation gives one child in Houston their own home library, 6 new books of their own that they get to choose. That's the big key. Not being handed a bunch of books they don't want. It's an awesome event where they go and pick all 6 of their books. It's great. So text new books, all one word. That's new books to 41444 to donate and help us help Houston kids. All donations in Morning Drive are going to be matched by Reliant. So when you donate 30, it's really 60 because Reliant is donating up to $10,000. They're going to be matching donations this morning. Text new books to 41444. Nick Caserio's game day superstition is the least surprising thing ever. That's coming up next.
DC sports fans start their day with 106.7 The Fan's Sports Junkies.
Let Jaden cook.
With Commanders Talk.
They were 60 minutes away from the Super Bowl last year, and they're better this year.
And a lot of fun.
You're acting like I haven't been embarrassed in my life before.
Right. Every morning from 6 to 10.
I thought I handled myself with incredible maturity.
If you missed it live, listen to 106.7 The Fan Sports Junkies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
They're listening to everything you do.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Seth, your Trajan Wealth live read got some traction.
I gave everybody some tough love.
Some tough love. You went old school.
I gave some good hard coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is a fake text, I'm pretty sure. Hey, Seth, Trajan Wealth here. Just skip reading our ad tomorrow. You're fired. Scram. Oh, Scram's my favorite.
You're pretty sure that's not actually the people at Trajan Wealth?
Well, I'm pretty sure it is because I actually edited the text because it says Trajan Health and they misspelled Trajan. T-R-A-G-E-N. I'm pretty sure the Trajan Wealth people know how to spell their company name. My favorite one is the person that called you a 401k Karen.
401 Karen.
You're
afraid
the K's
I'm going to lean into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. I'll tell you what, when it comes to taking tough love or coaching at all, honestly, I'm a little bit worried about some of you guys because yesterday you and I were going over some of the things that needed to be corrected from the Texans game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I never once remember predicting or forecasting doom or that like there was no way out of this or anything. We're just doing like what football coaches do after any game, including the wins. Like this is what needs to get better. And I got an email from one of our listeners that basically said, Seth, that's enough. You are, what was the word that he used? It was like abusing the Texans or whatever.
What?
Like I come to listen to you for entertainment, not to be just told how awful they are. Give them a little bit of time. And I'm like, man, you would be, if I were coaching you, I might have to kick you off the team.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Like, you can't point out what's wrong and what needs to be fixed, and you're going to be sensitive on behalf of other men? Sean and I, if you're going to accuse Sean and I of being the over-the-top vicious when discussing teams or what they're obviously not doing well, I don't know. You just don't have an appetite for life, I don't think.
No.
Accept the coaching, man.
Yeah.
Accept the coaching.
I would say, and you know what? I would submit that all the things we were saying were things that the Texans themselves largely agree with about that game. It's not a bunch of dummies over there that didn't see what happened on Sunday. It needs to get better. They didn't score a touchdown.
When one of my favorite things to do back when I was more just combative on social media, and X specifically, formerly known as Twitter, was take like a quote from Jeremy Lin and basically say the exact same thing when he criticized something he did after a game. Take the same quote, and instead of I, turn it into he, like just change the pronouns on it. And the amount of hate you would get from people just livid that you're being mean to Jeremy Lin. I'm like, I am rephrasing exactly what he said, almost verbatim. Settle the hell down,
wow,
man.
Wow, what an just experiment. Settle down. I love that. Yeah. That's a great experiment. So Nick Caserio was on Texans All Access yesterday, and this was the least surprising thing that he said. He was asked by John and Mark about what does he have a game day superstition. Here's what Nick Caserio's game day superstition is.
I try to work out each game day. So when we're here at the stadium, I jump on a VersaClimber. For those of you that don't know what the VersaClimber is, I wouldn't recommend it because it's not easy. But I try to do that. I mean, I enjoy exercise. I enjoy working out. So when I'm on the road, there's not really too much, you know, try to do the same thing. You try to make it as consistent as possible. But that's probably one thing. When I was playing, I was a stickler. I was probably a maniac. Now I've gotten a little bit older. Honestly, some of that stuff doesn't really work. So you just got to do something to really settle the mind a little bit and just kind of put you in a position where you can focus on the job at hand.
Superstition for Nick Caserio, time on the VersaClimber. Surprise factor, zero.
Yeah. The VersaClimber, for those of you who don't know, is the machine where your arms are moving up and down as your legs are moving up and down.
Sounds
as well.
Miserable.
Like you're mountain climbing or something.
Oh.
On a very easy, a technically easy rock.
Have you ever done the VersaClimber before?
Yeah, I used to love the VersaClimber.
Really?
Awesome. Very low impact, yeah.
Okay.
So it's low impact but grueling.
Yeah.
Any kind of those climbing machines, the ladders. I like those ones where it's just a rung after rung after rung, like it's a treadmill of rungs that you climb. Love those. Yeah.
How long do you think Nick goes on the VersaClimber for?
I don't know. It depends on if he does intervals or if he's going steady state. There's all any matter of time you could go.
Oh, there is. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a little wow, you can do
anything at a low intensity or high intensity.
Yeah,
guessing that Nick is more of a high intensity intervals, like 3 to 5 minutes at a clip or something.
Okay.
That's the most grueling way to do it. The old MMA interval type workout.
Yeah.
So you're going 5 minutes at a time, super hard.
Full body.
Anything full body is badass. I'm reading, you know what's interesting about that is I'm reading this book, autobiography. It's a book of stories by Dan Gable, who is one of the best wrestlers of all time. And Dan Gable is known as just being this. And then he went on to be one of the best wrestling coaches of all time.
He's a maniac.
But was just, it's like a psychotic maniac in terms of working out. But he said one of the turning points for him in his young life was that he had lost a wrestling match, and he went home, like when he was 9 years old or something.
Back when he
went
lost.
Home, and it was like the first time he had ever lost. No, you know what it was? It was a swim meet.
Oh.
So it wasn't even a wrestling match. Because he went undefeated in high school and then undefeated all the way through college until the final match of his college career he lost.
Wow.
And then he went on to, I think when he won the Olympic gold medal, he didn't have a single point scored on him.
Jeez.
Either that or the world championship, whatever. But so when he was a real young kid, for the first time in his life, he had lost anything at all because he got second in a swim meet. And he went home and he was sulking about it. And his parents were not like the kind of parents that drive their kids hard or anything. But his mom got to a point where she basically said, you got to quit sulking and being a baby about this. Go shovel the driveway. And so he went out and shoveled the driveway. And he said, as he was doing it, he realized like, oh, I feel better. So he went and shoveled the neighbor's driveway and then the neighbor's driveway and the neighbor's driveway and the neighbor's driveway. So I got to thinking about Gable and just high achievers in general about the whole that dynamic of kind of, having that attitude, or once you can flip that switch to realizing that, boy, how do I respond to adversity or defeat? It's like, oh, I feel better when I just get back out there and start exercising
or
working harder or anything. And his, like, he was a maniacal worker. But then at Iowa, when he was a coach, his players, like, his wrestlers were the exact same way. They were just psychotically hard workers.
Well, and I think, and we're going to play D'Amico in the next segment talking about flushing week one of the NFL out. I imagine it's similar for football players, right?
Like, yeah, it's a lot easier as a player than as a fan.
Yeah.
It's, you get in on Monday, you watch the film, and then you got work to do. If you end up, spend any time sulking, you're mentally weak.
Yep.
That was one of the best lessons I ever learned was, like, everybody loves to put on a display of how much they hate losing and how awful it is. But if you can't flip the switch, you're mentally soft. You know, and I think the same way with coaches, if you're still yelling at them on Thursday about a mistake they made on Sunday, you know, like, unless you're doing it conscientiously and with a specific purpose, you're just kind of sulking, right? You know, like, you got another game to win.
Yep.
The other part too, Sean, the life lesson in that, I think, is because we talked yesterday about, like, sometimes when people just, they put a little too much emphasis on being positive all the time. There's all manner of people that are super successful that, if anything, skew a little bit more to the pessimistic side of things. But it's those people that might be a little bit pessimistic, but that their response to the pessimism is to work their butts off.
Yes.
And they're fueled by that fear of failure. And it's not in vogue right now to lean into some of the darker sides of your personality, but there's so many great athletes and great business leaders or whatever that they have that side of them is just constantly in fear of. I've talked to so many Hall of Fame NFL players who basically before every game said that they were terrified they were going to suck.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm just going to, but Sally was like that. He's like, I'm going to suck. Oh, I'm going to suck. I'm going to suck. But his response to that, instead of despair or kind of going into a shell, is just as a motivator to work that much
totally,
harder.
Totally, dude.
Fear it's okay failure. To have negative thoughts. Yes. It's how you respond to them.
100%.
I worry that people watch too many TED Talks and they think that you should never be upset in the moment or anything. It's always happy, moving forward.
No,
It's how you respond to those moments where you just want to burn your house down and move to Mexico.
Amen. Yes. Amen. Okay. Someone saying they did the VersaClimber once. I didn't last 25 seconds on it. It sounds miserable.
I knew it because, you know, like, my brother was a really good wrestler. So I wrestled in high school, but I wasn't as good as my brother. But he wrestled in college and internationally. And, like, mm-hmm. the VersaClimber, the stair mill there, or the whatever that ladder mill is and everything, wrestlers love that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
They're just psychotic.
Oh, yeah. Vision Quest, man. When Loudon Swain took the pegs.
Yeah.
The pegboard, and he climbed all the way to the top. That was great.
They probably don't have pegboards anymore, do they?
Probably not.
It seems like a pretty big liability.
Probably a lot of liability from plummeting 40 feet up
that
the wall.
That 3/4-inch wrestling mat doesn't provide maybe just as a...
Less cushion than you'd think. Yeah. Kids, go watch Vision Quest. It's an 80s movie that actually aged pretty well, I would say.
And then to beg your parents to put in a pegboard on your house.
Thank you. Yes. All right, into the 9 o'clock hour we go. I mentioned D'Amico Ryans. He is flushing week one. We didn't do that with him earlier. We went back and we needed him to explain what went wrong. Now we are flushing it. We are looking ahead to Tampa Bay. Initial thoughts on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers from D'Amico Ryans is coming up next. We're trying to get books today into the hands of kids in low-income homes here in Houston. 79% of Houston falls into that category. The kids in Houston do. A $30 donation to the Barbara Bush Houston Literacy Foundation gets one of those children a home library. 6 new books that they can read. It's amazing how many kids, especially nowadays with phones and everything, how few words they even hear, let alone read. Literacy is huge for the quality of the society that we live in. So let's get some books in the hands of these kids. A simple $30 donation, which will be matched by Reliant, up to $10,000, is going to get a home library in the hands of these kids. New books. Text new books to 41444 today. That's new books, all one word, to 41444. It'll give you a link to donate and help these Houston kids for the Barbara Bush Houston Literacy Foundation.
DC sports fans start their day with 106.7 The Fan's Sports Junkies.
Let Jaden cook.
With Commanders Talk.
They were 60 minutes away from the Super Bowl last year, and they're better this year.
And a lot of fun.
You're acting like I haven't been embarrassed in my life before. Right.
Every morning from 6 to 10.
I thought I handled myself with incredible maturity.
If you missed it live, listen to 106.7 The Fan Sports Junkies on Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
They're listening to everything you do.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.